Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today is the 21st of March, 2018. Before I begin with the presentation, I again ask my friends for support. It is increasingly difficult to do this full-time as a researcher, writer, broadcaster, lecturer, activist, etc. Right now the movement is in disarray. And more than ever, need the support of our friends. I've been a professor at 4 universities. My student evaluations are always in the top 1%. Without fail. I was the most popular professor in Mount St. Mary's University history, without question. But that doesn't matter when it comes to political correctness. So what I'm supposed to do, my calling as a teacher in that regard, has been cut off to me, which has been very difficult. For that reason, to keep me on the air, to keep me functional, I beg of your support, and I'm sending my supporters unpublished books, and for some of you, works that I haven't quite completed. To get your opinion, as a incentive to donate to me. My website is www.rusjournal.org, rusjournal.org. Thank you very much to all my friends. The topic for today, like most of my topics, is by request. He's been out of the news recently, but back in 08, roughly, he was the talk of the Orthodox press, and this is Bishop Diomede of Chukotka. Chukotka is the most remote, far northeastern part of Russia. It rests on the Eastern Siberian Sea as well as the Bering Sea, and comes very close to bordering the U.S. Through the Alaskan Islands. Its high temperature in July is 55, and the low temperature is, I would really enjoy living there, except given the amount of snow that they get, the bugs that they get in the spring and early summer is terrifying because of so much standing water. I don't think it's irrelevant that he's from a very remote part of the country. I also don't think it's irrelevant that he did his master's thesis on Arseniy Matveyevich, the great saint, new martyr of the Catherinian yoke. He was tortured to death by Catherine the Great's police for his opposition to the secularization of monastic lands, and then selling them off or giving them to Catherine's friends. Catherine completely secularized the aristocracy, which was deeply Masonic by that time, and cut off the church from the ruling class, and cut off the church from many of the people, because the monasteries lost all their independence. Oftentimes, monastic wealth is condemned, sometimes rightly, though usually wrongly, but this was the social welfare system of Russia, if the extended family, for whatever reason, failed. It was also the guarantee of their independence. And this is not irrelevant to our topic, because Bishop Diomede was kicked out of the Russian Orthodox Church, the Moscow Patriarchate. Now, there's been controversy, and I don't want to ignore this, There's been controversy over his motivation for this. I don't know the details there. That what he eventually used to justify his separation from the Patriarchate was his real motivation. I've heard rumblings to that effect, but I haven't seen any hard evidence, so I'm going to ignore it. But I want to bring it up just for the sake of fairness. 2008, Diomede revolted against the policies of the Moscow Patriarchate. This has been an extremely difficult issue for me personally as well as professionally, because that Patriarchate contains many, many, many good people. I want to remind my listeners that the grace of God, which is nothing more than God's presence on earth, doesn't come from bishops. That would imply that grace is created and therefore heretical. Bishops don't control grace. They don't originate it. They can only point us to it. And this is the reason why they have to be monastics. Whenever you get liberalism in orthodoxy, which is such a ridiculous oxymoron, whenever you get that, you notice it's always imposed by force. Liberals and modernists are authoritarians. And whenever liberalism takes over a group of bishops, they use any technique possible to force it on people. They lie about their intentions. They get rid of dissenters. You know, they use force without mercy. And what ends up happening is the church ends up defining itself by the hierarchy. This is the main, and this is not often mentioned, but it's the main heresy of Sergianism. Whenever a church is cut off from tradition and cut off from its own people, the only thing it has left is its own personal power. I should say, not personal power, institutional power. Occasionally there's some charismatic authority there, but rarely. Liberals don't have a sense of humor. And they often can't talk to people. They lecture to people. And when in the middle of the 2000s, the church outside of Russia joined with the Moscow Patriarchate, I had mixed feelings. Only in this sick world can an event that made sense politically make no sense theologically. Russians were consolidating their forces, and with very good reason. As my listeners know, my biggest problem with Vladimir Putin and the Moscow Patriarchate is its membership in the World Council of Churches. The present patriarch, before he became patriarch, worked for them directly. His entire education was in Western Europe under the World Council of Churches. And you have Putin and Lukashenko, two warriors against the New World Order, enthusiastic about one of its important pillars, the WCC, founded by the Rockefellers after the war to create a one world religion. Or at very least, the minimum, to render doctrinal differences irrelevant and thus reject truth as such. If you reject truth, you reject Christ. Muslims and Jews don't worship any god. They're overwhelmingly atheistic, and they worship themselves as the healers of the world. God is a metaphor. We do not worship the same God as Islam because they reject the Trinity. And the question here is the value of truth. Christ said that he was the truth. And the way, the truth, the life, which is significant because he didn't say, I have the truth, but I am the truth manifested. Truth becomes a person primarily because we can relate to it better. We tend to personalize things. We personalize cars and guitars and pets. That's why monarchy is so important. Of course, Diomede pointed out many of the errors of the MP concerning the Tsar as well. Monarchy is generally condemned by the modernist churches. especially in America, the OCA and Antioch. But when I'm reading church history, especially modern church history, I'm extremely upset, and I'm getting more upset as time goes on, by the fact that authors only talk about bishops. They never talk about parishes, priests, monks, charismatic figures, which are the body of the church, the body of God, body of Christ on earth, as close as the Holy Spirit ever gets to being incarnated. He's not, of course, but that's an easy way to understand it. We're incorporated into his body, and that body sits at the right hand of God the Father. Glorified flesh. Flesh, therefore, is not evil. Its perversion by the modern system, of course, is. And it's condemned largely out of prejudice. The regime projects its own failings onto us. They're authoritarian, they project it onto us. They're hate-filled and angry, they project that onto us. They're humorless and dour, they project that onto us. And the opposite is usually true in our case. There's nothing more bizarre than hearing Antifa psychopaths screeching, calling for the deaths of people like me because they're fighting hate. Obviously and manifestly, the hatred is exclusively on their side. I've taken some heat from the two broadcasts ago concerning the racial issue. Of course, it's all out of fear, and no one ever bothers to listen or read. And so they invent whatever they want, and it's therefore a simple matter of prejudice. Prejudice means to prejudge. And again, as always, they simply project their failings onto us. In my book on Vladimir Putin, I speculated, it's not really the purpose of the book, but I mention it in the introduction, that Western leaders secretly envy Putin. Now, of course, I obviously have no proof of that. Any argument that talks about jealousy or anger or hate is bound to fail because we don't know what's going on inside of anyone's mind. No argument can work that way unless you know the person intimately well. But Putin is independent. They are dependent. Putin can march into a billionaire's shareholder meeting and tell him what to do. Where in America, the opposite is the case. They tell the president what to do. They are, whatever it is, it's constant projection, prejudice, anger, and in that case, envy. Not to mention the fact, as my listeners know, just a few days ago, Putin was reelected president with, I believe it was about 73 or 74% of the vote in a five-way race, which is unheard of. Now, the election was, of course, free and fair because it is in line with his popularity ratings. There's no rating agency, including the American ones, that put his approval anything under 70. And that's never been the case. It's never dipped below 70, generally speaking. So, and as always, U.S. interfered radically in the Russian elections, making the accusation of Russian meddling so bizarre in America. It's bizarre because the U.S. has this as a matter of policy to meddle and even create elections in other countries. They set up the structure for elections in Iraq, for example, banning any nationalist party, banning the Ba'ath Party, banning the Social Nationalist Party, anything they didn't like. The left wants to ban and destroy physically anything it hates or doesn't understand. They project that onto us. That's all they do. They're a neurotic group of people. I've never made the argument, neither has Diomede or any other Orthodox nationalist, that there's a genetic component to any of this. The race or ethnicity, these are manifestations of culture and God's presence. Race is a biological reality, that is true. And genetics does play a big role in certain abilities, that's true. But it does not determine them. So Diomede, that very same year, was removed from his position as Bishop of the Northeast. And he didn't show up to a trial, which, by the way, sounds familiar. Unlike me, he didn't resign his position beforehand, but he realized that given the nature of his accusations, his chance of winning was zero. Usually, whenever an institution like that will hold a hearing, university, a private institution, the chances of the accused winning is pretty much zero. Once the institution has made up its mind, so for example, when I was removed from Mount St. Mary's University, there was a post facto hearing, which of course doesn't make sense. What do you think the chances are that the professors on that board are going to go against the provost for my sake? The provost being known, David Ream, as power mad, firing guys right and left, being very threatened by the intelligence and abilities of others. This is what he was known for universally. They're not going to get on his bad side for me. One of my friends from there quipped that he actually heard David Reams say that he has no chance of winning, meaning me. They're not going to humiliate themselves and say, "Oh my God, Dr. Johnson, we are so sorry, we were so wrong about you," and then reinstate me. They're not going to give me that kind of power. That's a huge victory, and it's a humiliation for the institution. So I know they're not going to do it. That's the case with all of these things. Private sector hearings and private judicial matters are a fait accompli. You don't know the number of times I've heard from chairmen and deans and universities, students come and go, but the institution remains. They don't care about students. They never have. They're going to be gone in a couple of years, so why, you know, get attached to them? Anyway, what was the nature of Diomede's accusation? One of his arguments was that the Russian Church, that is to say, the Moscow Patriarchate, the institution of the Synod, which is not identical with the Church, of course, has no legitimacy. And it's hard to argue with that, because as we all know, the Church was created by Stalin in 1944 and forced to toe the line. The World Council of Churches was an absolutely essential, really only the only mission of that church under the Soviets. And they supported Marxist regimes around the world and sought, of course, the complete destruction of any dogmatic differences amongst religions. Moscow Patriarchate, again, contained, you know, grace doesn't come from bishops. There are many institutions within the Moscow Patriarchate that have grace. It doesn't come from bishops or the institution. God's not going to punish people because their bishops are ludicrous. I'm going to make this loud and clear. The traditionalist, the catacomb church of Russia is an absolute joke. It is splintered into, last count, 20 tiny sectarian groups. And I do this full time, and I can't keep up with their splitting. None of them are legitimate because they are splitting for non-dogmatic reasons. Now, Diomede's split from the Patriarchate was legitimate because it was based exclusively on dogma. But within that group, it never is. Occasionally, they'll find some excuse post facto, like in the case of Auxentius of Athens. And none of that turns out to be true. But even if it were true, it's still not justification for a split. None of these schisms from the Matthewites onward have any justification in doctrine. And most of the time they didn't even pretend they did. It's ego, it's anger, it's hypersensitivity, it's distrust, it's demonic action. Now, common sense will say that all of these groups, as groups and as institutions, have the grace of God, because you can't come to the and live the Orthodox tradition without grace. That's not something that comes natural to us. Therefore, manifestly, they're graceful. And they perform miracles, and you know, it happens all the time. But for the average parishioner, which is really what this is all about, it's extremely confusing, and you cannot blame a parishioner for not leaving the Moscow Patriarchate. And it is the fault exclusively of these true Orthodox bishops who, first of all, err in thinking that the bishop is the church. Number two, they err that grace comes from them, that institutions are the only thing that matter, soborns are the only thing that matter. And three, that they're leaving for non-dogmatic reasons. So you have at least three errors in their constant arrogant schisms. And I condemn it to the skies. If it were a unified movement, it would have long since taken over Orthodoxy by now. Matthew was the one who started it. He may have been a holy man. They had holy people. Of course they did. That's not the point. He made it okay to go into schism for non-dogmatic reasons. Or semi-dogmatic. I mean, later on, of course, years later, they come up with some justification. That's not the reason why they go into schism. He made it okay. And ever since then, if, you know, I estimate that there are about 50 true Orthodox groups around the world, probably more than that, with five of any real size and significance. Had they been unified throughout the world, they would have taken over world Orthodoxy by now. And our world would look a lot different. It's something that prevents the monarchy from coming back to Russia, because there's no church that everyone agrees on to anoint him. The Moscow Patriarchate won't do that. You know, their entire existence derives from the condemnation of the monarchy. This is absolutely essential to Diomede's position. Of course, this is essential to Orthodox nationalism in Russia in general. A group of monks from Solovki, very early on, in 1918, were thrown in prison by the Cheka, which was the original Red Guards, Lenin's Jewish revolutionaries. They wrote an appeal to anyone who was willing to cooperate with the Reds. They said that these, I'm sorry, I erred. This is in the early 20s. This is when you were developing, churches were developing that were trying to cooperate with the Soviet state. They said that this church is a new institution. It has no institutional relations with the church that existed under the Tsarist period, because all of these bishops were destroyed. These dioceses were plundered. Peter the Great did the same thing. Peter the Great would have done exactly what Lenin did, except that he simply didn't have the money, the attention span, the time, and especially the technology to do so systematically. The contradiction between claiming to be Orthodox and yet agreeing with a state that has as one of its major planks the destruction of Orthodoxy is too great. Previous foreign occupiers in different parts of the world, you can make a different claim. But as far as the communist state is concerned, the Jewish state of the Soviet Union said our goal, one of our goals, is the total eradication of Orthodoxy from the planet. Their institutions, their newspapers and journals slandered the Orthodox Church every day, and Sergius and his friends had to sign off on this. Or at the very least, stay silent about it. Marxism, Leninism, Maoism, capitalism, all modern ideologies only concern themselves with production, what they consider progress, technology, and worldly welfare for the few. The many are irrelevant. Their concern is for the few, but regardless, it is purely mundane. It is purely worldly. And that there is absolutely no mercy in these institutions. In capitalism, the private sector writes the laws and enforces them. In the Soviet Union, the party does as it pleases, because by definition, they claim that they were the voice of the working class. Very few workers actually had anything to do with the party. That's the case with parties around the world. There are Jewish urbanites having nothing to do with the peasantry and rarely having anything to do with the industrial workers, which is why they had to lie about their positions running for office prior to the revolution. But the Moscow Patriarchate has to sign off on all of this. Originally, Sergius, now I'm very sympathetic to the man. Americans who condemn Sergius need to shut their mouths, because they, in Sergius' position, would be on Red Square flying the red banner. Sergius was tortured in prison. He was released April 2nd, 1927, and was told that he would go back if he didn't sign something that would support the Soviet state, but that the Soviets would begin killing more and more priests and bishops and their families if he didn't. What would you have done? Very few of you, I dare to say none of you, myself included, wouldn't have written something like the Declaration. Of course, in general, we can say it was a terrible thing, and it was. St. Peter of Krititsa, who was actually should have been the patriarch in normal circumstances, was tortured to death. You know, in the freezing cells of the Russian prison camp system, he developed diseases. His immune system went to nothing. And God knows he had parasites. He had everything. This is how he died. And he was offered a normal life if he capitulated, and he refused. This is why he is Saint Peter. Now, the Moscow Patriarchate had to say that that didn't happen. There's no religious persecution in the country, which is what the Moscow Patriarchate said up until communism fell. They did all they could to eradicate the true Orthodox Church. There is no institutional connection between the Tsarist Orthodox Church and what became the Sergian regime. And this is because the party had purged every diocese, destroyed most of the parishes and monasteries, and arbitrarily brought a few bishops out of prison and created a so-called synod under Stalin's orders. And that became the Patriarchate. Institutionally, there's absolutely no justification for its existence. Again, God is not a monster. He's not going to condemn people who stay within it because it's so large, when the alternatives are so splintered and scattered. All of these groups have grace. So maybe there's not so much of an excuse, but you could understand, because they have normally anathematized each other. And it's bad enough that they split for non-dogmatic reasons, knowing that they're destroying their own witness in doing so. But then they have to anathematize others, often on ridiculous non-doctrinal grounds. Some of these splits and schisms are so bad, there is no good reason for it, other than that they just wanted to run their own show. I have the feeling, in fact, I almost know to be a fact, that the true Orthodox Church, and there's many, many holy people there, and bishops and everything else, if world Orthodoxy were to turn back to the true faith, they would not be reconciled. When Bulgaria and Georgia pulled out of the World Council of Churches, the true Orthodox yawned. They will not, because they are used to running their own show. Now, I know that Sergius was tortured in prison, and the Soviets were using all manner of new brainwashing techniques. Because initially, Sergius refused to condemn the bishops outside of Russia, the monarchist movement that fled with the White Armies after the end of the Civil War, led by Anthony Kropivitsky. I want to say, by the way, the present Church Abroad, based in New York, has no institutional connection to that church. The present ROCOR condemns everything that Anastasi, Averky stood for. That's been coming out more and more. And I say this because since the merger of the MP and the ROCOR, the church has been purged. About half of its members and clergy have left. There was a book burning at Jordanville soon thereafter of everything that condemned the Moscow Patriarchate, including things from St. Philaret and others. They are now in communion with the utterly empty and graceless Antiochian Church in America or the Ecumenical Patriarchate. They're in communion with Freemasonry and the World Council of Churches. Most of their members don't like that fact, but it happens to be true, and which is why I couldn't in good conscience stay in the Ukrainian church that I had come into as a young man. Sergius initially agreed with the Solovki monks' appeal in the 1920s, but he still wanted compromise. He thought that the Soviet state was a fait accompli, that the West had supported it, had backed it, and therefore he had no choice. And there's a theory floating around out there that may have some use, that the early Eurasianist movement had considered the revolution foreign in its origin, Jewish in its origin, but that's such a weak and fragile foundation. Soon, Bolshevism will become Russian and become a Eurasianist movement rather than just a cosmopolitan Jewish socialist one. Sergius was influenced by these people early on, that Marxism and Bolshevism only in rhetoric have anything in common, but that very soon Bolshevism will be Russianized and become a powerful force for unification. The thing that struck Sergius and people in Joseph of Petrograd and people like this was that the Orthodox Church had sponsored actual, real, functioning socialist institutions. Like the Brotherhood of the Holy Cross, for example. I did a whole, podcast on that. The monastics, the peasant commune, the artels. These were real, functional, traditional forms of socialism. They were Christian and idealistic, not materialistic, not based on the state. But they existed. They were all smashed without mercy. This is suspicious. If your purpose is to create socialism, why would you destroy actual socialist institutions? At the minimum, you would want to at least influence them, not annihilate them. And this is part of the reason that I've always claimed that Soviet Marxism, being Jewish and cosmopolitan at its root, never had any concern for labor at all. That was just sheer rhetoric. They never cared about that. You can't take these people at their word. They're schemers. This has nothing to do with labor. Was never benefited, not in the slightest bit, by any Soviet legislation. Or if it was passed, it was never enforced. And this was true throughout the entire existence of the Soviet Union. It had nothing to do with socialism. It had nothing to do with labor. It had nothing to do with any kind of community. It was designed to simply suck every bit of value out of the Russian worker possible. Again, they projected their own greed onto what they call capitalism. Now, I also want to take a moment here to say that those leftists who claim that this wasn't really communism, to that I reply, well then, Western Europe and America aren't really capitalism. You can't get away with that. The dishonesty there is that you are putting up an ideal of something against the reality of something else. The reality of day-to-day capitalism is awful. It is dishonest, though, to put a strictly idealistic set of ideas against it. No, you have to put it into practice. And every time it's been put into practice, it's ended up the exact same way. Tito being a bit different, but still anti-religious. So, yeah, it was socialism, because this is what socialism is. The rhetoric of the writers is not the day-to-day operation of the institution. If you say that that's not real socialism, then I say, well, this isn't real capitalism. Because I could put up the ideals of the West, whether I agree with them or not, I could make them ideals and put them up against the reality of the USSR. Two can play at that game. It is dishonest to confront a actual functioning system, people with power and making decisions, with a purely ideal set of concepts. So yes, it was socialism. It was Marxism. It was Leninism. It was supported by communists throughout the world. The only reason that people began splitting with the USSR was that Stalin began purging the older Bolsheviks, which of course were all entirely Jews. He was not anti-Semitic by any means. He surrounded himself with Jews. In purging the old guard, they were all Jews anyway, so it appeared to be anti-Semitism. It wasn't. It's just that they were all Jews. Again, I'm going through all of this because this is absolutely essential to Diomede's criticism and the reason why he left the Moscow Patriarchate and the reason why he was front page news for a while. Sergius was released from prison in 1927. And he then wrote and signed his declaration. Really, there are 3 points that it's a short declaration, and 3 points there. Number one, we can be both Russian Orthodox people and good, productive citizens of the USSR. Number two, the USSR is our civic fatherland. That's precisely what the Russian says. They don't call it a nation in any way. But the most obnoxious was that number three, the USSR is from God and is his design for the progress of the human race. It's not even a necessary evil, it's a good thing. The point of me going through all of this is to buttress Diomede's position that the Moscow Patriarchate, the same Patriarchate that ordained him, didn't have, that there was no institutional connection to the Tsarist Church. It had been so purged that calling it the same church is ridiculous. I say the same thing for Peter the Great, because he removed every bishop. The first persecution, the Jewish attack on the Russian Orthodox Church, was roughly 1921, 1928. They organized all kinds of attacks, protests, reading rooms, lectures, and many of these failed because these Jews, having really no contact with Orthodox people, didn't really know what they thought. And essentially, they claimed things they didn't believe. It was all just prejudice. They wanted to create debates that they had a tendency to lose. And so they stopped the debate idea. Because these Jews would go out there arrogantly, thinking these people were all just country bumpkins. And the Emelian Yaroslavsky, who was Jewish, who was the head of the League of the Militant Godless, formed in 1925, that was really behind all of it. It was a very Jewish group, and the purpose of which was to eradicate the church, but their methods were ham-handed, no pun intended, and actually pun was intended, they were failures. Physical force is the only thing that mattered. They forbade educated believers in the party. If they were ignorant about the faith, they could practice it at home, we won't say anything. Clergy who were popular were targeted. 28 bishops were murdered. 7,000 priests in the first wave of persecutions. Now, I want you to keep in mind, the public didn't stay silent. After the Civil War, there were, the Civil War continued right up until the German invasion. It's that simple. The population, exhausted from the war, World War I and the Civil War, still didn't want it, but remained adamant in their defense of the churches. The church was the monarchy, it was old Russia, it was tradition. There is no Russian Orthodox culture without the church. The church and the culture are the same. So what I'm trying to say is that there were armed clashes. The Cheka says there were 1,500 from 1921-1922 alone, armed clashes over church closings. Lenin admitted in a letter to Molotov in 1922 that the Church Valuables campaign, after the Civil War, the famine that was caused by communist policies, the church was, you know, handed over its valuables so we could sell it and make money for the poor. No one bought that at all. That was just a pretext. Now, the church donated huge amounts of money for the poor, by the way, which were kept out of the Western press and the Soviet press. But liturgical items couldn't be. The church doesn't own those things. The church can't sell something it doesn't own. Things like, you know, chalices and the, you know, gilding and the iconostasis, that's not owned by anybody. You can't sell them. It would be against the canons. It would be a deadly sin. So that's what Lenin grabbed onto and said, ah, they're greedy. They don't care about people. That's exactly what the Western press wrote, and that's what the Soviet press wrote. The Western press simply repeated everything that came from the USSR, showing the clear acceptance and even devotion to the Soviet Union of the American ruling class. But in his letter to Molotov, he says that this is BS. This is just a pretext. What he was trying to do, and he says it in this letter, that he was trying to provoke clashes between the population and the police. The Living Church was created in 1922. Another failure. This was a group of liberals, arrogant, urbanite. They wanted to, you know, eliminate services. They wanted to eliminate fasting. They wanted to have married bishops. They didn't like monastics. It was absolute nonsense. And despite tremendous subsidies from the Soviet Union, from the Soviet government, they failed to actually attract anyone. I want to point out again that the Patriarch of Constantinople accepted and was in communion with this Living Church. The Living Church claimed that being anti-Soviet was the same as being anti-Semitic. Very odd claim to make. The point is, Sergius and the new church that had come into existence, and Sergius only made it, he was head of the church, he was made a metropolitan in 1944, but he was head of the church from the 20s onward. He had to sign off on all of this. His prediction, his belief that the Bolsheviks would turn Russian completely failed. It didn't come true. And he attempted to root out the Russian True Orthodox, who were the Catacomb Church, which did have an institutional connection to Tsarism, as well as the church abroad, which also did. So I want to make two points here, and Diomede makes them as well. Number one, the institution that Sergius ran from the 20s onward has no institutional connection to the Tsarist era church. It doesn't. It had been purged so badly that you can't call it the same institution. This is why I'm opposed to it. Number two, I want to say the same thing about the church abroad, that from roughly 2000 onward, the union with the MP, the attempted abuse of Vitali and everything else, that this this ended, it became a major purge of the institutions. And the ROCOR today bears no resemblance, really in any respect, to the ROCOR of decades ago. Now, I know I said that most of us, if you're being threatened, you just come out of prison, you're tortured in prison, you're brainwashed, you are told that if you don't sign this thing, we're going to kill more priests. Of course, most of us would sign it. However, proving the grace in this institution, superhuman grace, 26 bishops immediately separated from Sergius. It was 40. By 1930. There were 150 bishops in the USSR in 1927. 80 came out publicly against it and came out against Sergius. The Church of the Tsarist Era, which had two branches, the church that went underground and the church that fled abroad, had a synod in 1925. This is before the declaration, but of course, Sergius was already pro-Soviet in many of his views. 1925 synod said that he is without grace, that he is a usurper, that he is a fraud, that there is no connection between the church that he controls, I should say the entity that he controls, and the pre-revolutionary Tsarist era Orthodox Church. And therefore, institutionally, they don't have the grace of the sacraments. These have never been withdrawn. Therefore, we can't in good conscience commune with the Moscow Patriarchate. I mean, this is just the beginning of what you can do here. And this is what Diomede, really, the fact that this began in the Petrine era, it was reversed in parts of the 19th century. This is something that Diomede was working on from his master's thesis onward. That's why he picked St. Arsenia as his topic. The other argument that he makes is 1613, the most representative assembly in Russian history, came together after the time of troubles and elected Mikhail Romanov, the monarch. This represented all classes, peasantry, Cossacks, nobles, churchmen, townsmen, and a huge synod. It was seen as the synod of the church, by the way, because there were dozens of bishops there. This wasn't a civil matter. They anathematized anybody that came out against the monarchy, and that the crown will rule Russia forever. I'm not entirely sure if they meant the Romanov family, or the Tsar of Russia, of one form or another. That has also never been withdrawn. They condemn anyone who rejects the monarchy with excommunication immediately upon any public manifestation of the rejection of the monarchy in Russia in any form. So in 2008, he wrote his appeal. I've mentioned this already. I'm going to continue the discussion of that because he says that there were joint prayers with the Roman Catholics in Notre Dame and many other places. We know this is a fact. The canons from the apostolic era condemn prayers with heretics. I mean, there are so many reasons to see that the Russian Orthodox Church, Moscow Patriarchate, has no connection with the Tsarist era church. Or Christianity. And the only reason this isn't fought is because bishops live in fear. They're creatures of the Soviet system, and they're petrified that they'll end up like St. Peter of Krutitsa if they dissent. And we can't blame them for that. Not everyone has the strength to be tortured to death. That, like so many churches today, they're social clubs. That the church, as early as 1917, accepted and was complicit in, active in, the overthrow of the monarchy. Then he soon after anathematized the Moscow Patriarchate as such. It's really hard canonically to, or historically, to argue with him. Now, this doesn't mean that God's grace is not present an Orthodox people within that group. Grace is not dependent on the group. God takes care of his people, period. This isn't an institutional religion. This is a communal one. It's an organism, not an organization. We need to take that seriously. Bishops are usually troublemakers. We need them for obvious reasons, but, you know, they're usually troublemakers. He also, in 2018, has taken my position on the so-called name worship issue, which is a non-issue. He claims that in rejection of the notion that our knowledge and understanding, the truth about God, is in fact God's energy, means that they have accepted the heresy of Barlaam. Now, I have teased out that argument before. There's a paper on my website about it. I don't want to get into it too much, but I will repeat it again. There is no one in the church that worships the name, you know, Yahweh or God, whatever it is, as such. They would have to be, they should be locked up. And he makes that very point. That it's a non-issue. Grace is God's presence on earth. That's how it should be understood. It's his action on earth. This is divinity, by definition. When you deny this, you are relativizing theology. And this is what ultimately his claim is. The so-called name worship idea is a very, very sneaky way to cut off theology from the divine, making it a purely human institution. This was Vladimir Ernst's point of view. Those who wrote the 1913 Anathema, which was very, very poorly written and not well thought out, although they were good men, didn't understand this, and they didn't consider this consequence. It is a very dense argument that none of these people, and not very few people today, are prepared to understand. That's why it's so destructive. No one worships a name. That's not what the word name is. A name or a word in the ancient medieval worlds does not mean the same thing as does today. It's a knowledge, an understanding, how God is manifested with the icons of the sacraments. That is God's energies on earth, by definition. If you deny that, you are cutting off our theology from the divine itself, thereby rendering it changeable at will. And of course, that's the point. It is nominalism as applied to theology. No one, I'll repeat it again, worships a name. The so-called name glorifiers never say that. They condemn that because it's idolatry. No one believes that. And it leads to some ridiculous, you know, if you actually believe that the name is God, the name itself, you can write it down on a piece of paper, and that's God, you know, again, you should be institutionalized, then why would you need sacraments? Why would you need the church at all? It's a ridiculous position. No one holds it. This was one of the excuses that the Milan Synod used to get rid of me. And they were too dumb to understand what I was trying to tell them. Diomede has taken my position on this. I don't know if he was actively knew my material. I think I'm the only one. I know I'm the only one saying this, so it has to be. He could have come to it himself, independently. But it is also something that Metropolitan Gregory in Boston, the same argument. At least in English, there's two of us now who are saying this, and I learned this from Metropolitan Gregory. He's the one who, after the Milan Synod had the so-called autonomous Metropolitan, condemned name worship, a very ham-handed way to do it. He drove to see me twice and begged me to reason with them, and I tried. And he set me straight. I had to change my opinion entirely, and he was right. No one worships a name. That is laughable. But Diomede's essential concept, and I'll say it again, there is no institutional connection between what the communists created under Sergius with the church that existed prior to the revolution. And there's a thousand different ways you can make that argument. The simplest one is talking about simply the purges. In March 9th of 1917, the Russian Synod said that the provisional government was from God, that this was God's great gift to us. It went so far as to say that the monarchy is the reason that Russia is being punished today, that royalism is a sin, that God has been punished, that Russia has been punished by God because of the monarchy, and that the crown is the result, is a cause, I should say, of all of Russia's problems. They make this very, very clear. It's an ignorant, laughable paper, signed, unfortunately, by St. Tikhon and seven other bishops. There was no objection to his overthrow, no objection to his imprisonment. Not only that, they added voluntarily, prior to the provisional government, Kerensky, of course, with a 33rd degree Freemason, within the liturgy itself. Now we talk about Sergius' declaration. We don't talk about the declaration of the synod in favor of Kerensky. And it's very odd that Russian nationalists and the hardcore traditionalists and all this refuse to talk about that, and Tikhon was complicit in that. And again, he's still a saint. No one's perfect. But he was. He signed the document saying that the provisional government is from God and is a manifestation of God's mercy and love for us. Not as a necessary evil, and that's just as bad as what Sergius did. The white armies were fighting for the provisional government. There were royalists within their ranks, but that wasn't the focus. And by the way, that was a decree number 1893 in March of 1917. Monarchists are called worthless people in it. Sergius' position and the nature of Sergianism, again, another concept that's been bungled by people who don't understand. Sergius's the sin of Sergianism has, or the heresy of Sergianism has several components. Number one is the concept that the church can, or the church should support any power that comes into existence, no matter how they got there, and no matter what their ideology is. No. The only power that's from God is the Orthodox monarchy. That's number one. The second error they make is, or the second reason why they're heretics, is that the church as an institution is the origin and creator of grace. The church as an institution, not as an organism, not as a living being, but as a legal entity, is the origin and creation of grace. It is brutally heretical. Again, no one's saying that, but Diomede and myself. I don't know if any of you have noticed, but the Serbian church has re-entered the World Council of Churches. A few years ago, Bulgaria, Georgia, and Serbia had left the World Council. Serbia has rejoined it. Again, I want to condemn the Moscow Patriarchate and indirectly Putin's support of it relative to the World Council of Churches. It is a massive error, and I wish he would stop it. The same thing goes for Lukashenko. To this day, I have no idea why he does it. These are Putin's enemies. The fake Archbishop Macarius of Kenya says that nationalism is a disease. This is at a World Council of Churches a conference. They condemn Brexit in 2016. They're demanding, and all the members are signing off on this, mass large-scale integration of refugees all throughout, or migrants all throughout Europe. Again, these churches are signing off on this. You can't avoid it. You can't be a member of the World Council of Churches and refuse these things. They're signing this. They may put up a traditionalist front for their people, but behind their backs, this is the crap that they're doing. This is why Diomede went into revolt. This is why he was removed from the church. And it's also why he then anathematized the Moscow Patriarchate. But in doing so, all he did was repeat the catacomb, the underground church's anathema of Sergius very early on. Over and over and over again, the catacomb church, the underground church in the Soviet Union, that actually had the connection with the pre-revolutionary church and the apostolic tradition, anathematized the Moscow Patriarchate repeatedly. That is how it is. Supporting the Moscow Patriarchate is supporting Antioch and Greece and Freemasonry and idiots like Macarius in Kenya. The World Council of Churches is nothing more, according to Diomede, than a manifestation of Jewish rule. And he also claims that Solomon is the icon of the New World Order. That 666 refers to, as you see in 2 Chronicles 9, is a tribute in gold that he received, the talents he received every year. That's where the 666's origin. It's his worship of money. And of course, in that particular chapter, the Queen of Sheba becomes enamored with Solomon because of this. So this also has to do with lust. It has to do with adultery. It has to do with paganism. It has to do with apostasy. This is what 666 means. It's already ruling here. Globalism is Judaism. And for this, he was removed from the church. For this, he was humiliated in the press. He was called every name in the book. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? We need to support him. We need to support one another. I thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.